Well, we have spent a good deal of time looking at the Ten Commandments, and I hope that you are seeing through the Ten Commandments just how much God loves this fledgling group of people called the Israelites. God brought them into being by calling them out of nothing. I mean, he gave the call to Abraham, and he said, I'm going to make you into a great nation. You're going to have land, you're going to have people, et cetera, et cetera. Abraham didn't necessarily believe him because, well, he was childless. It's kind of hard to propagate a nation when you don't have any kids. So God took care of that. And through Abraham and then through Isaac and then into Jacob, he gave them an opportunity to become a nation numerically because he, through a famine, allowed them to go into Egypt. And even though they were oppressed for a number of years and enslaved, yet God allowed them to become a nation, to numerically become large. Some estimates say that by the time Moses came around, there were probably close to 2 to 3 million people. That's a nation. And so God provided for this Israelite people. He allowed them to have numbers. He allowed them to have human leadership through Moses and then eventually through the 70 elders. He gave them land, the promised land, Canaan. He gave them laws. He gave them the opportunity to be governed in a righteous kind of a way. And God did everything for the Israelites. They were his children. And that's what parents do for their children. You try to do everything you can for them. Now you want them to grow up to be independent thinkers and to be able to solve problems on their own. But as much as you possibly can, as a parent, you do everything that you possibly can. You train them, you raise them, you feed them, you love them, you protect them, you do what you can for your children. And unfortunately, not every child appreciates that. What did Israel do to God? Well, they rebelled against him. They hated his laws. They betrayed God. They worshiped other gods. God, you're my parent, but I don't care. I'm going to worship Baal. He's now going to be my daddy. And unfortunately, God understands probably better than anybody else the disloyalty and the unbelief and the betrayal and the rebellion and the sin that happens when your children back away from you. They broke the commandments of God, and they often lived as if there were no rules. And sadly, that's one of the things that a lot of children buck against when mom and dad have rules in the house. Especially when the children are a little bit older. You know, they've gone off to college, they come back for a summer, and they don't particularly like the rules. And I don't know, I probably said this, maybe one of you said this, you know, you live under my roof, my rules, okay? We have a tendency to do that kind of a thing as parents. My house, my rules. Okay, so let's take that into a spiritual life. God is your father. God might be saying, my house, my rules. And unfortunately, as his children, we struggle. We struggle. We have this propensity over years since Adam and Eve, to break the rules of God. We're just not big fans of rules. And there are a lot of people that live by this motto, if you want to be happy, then you got to break the rules. Rules are meant for what? Breaking. That's what a lot of people believe. You know, it's sort of like we have this tendency, and if we're not going to break the rules, you know, directly break them, then we do kind of like what that great theologian Calvin and Hobbes did. Do you remember Calvin and Hobbes? Calvin, he's doing this dance. He's got poor Rosalind as his babysitter, and he's going, you know, other kids' games are all such a bore. They've got to have rules, and they got to keep score. Calvin ball is better by far. It's never the same. It's always bizarre. You don't need a team or a referee. You know that it's great because it's named after me. And then he keeps going on, and Rosalind is going, oh no, this was a mistake, because she had promised to play Calvin ball with Calvin. And throughout this series of cartoons, Calvin is playing Calvin ball, and Rosalind is falling into some of the traps. And then toward the end, we get to this one, and this is my favorite, because she's fallen into the area where she has to talk slowly. So she says, this game makes no sense. It's as if you're making it up as you go. And Calvin says, Hobbs, she stumbled into the perimeter of wisdom. Run. And then she goes, oh. Because that's what Calvin ball is. There are no rules. You can change it as you go. The game is made up completely. And can you imagine if that is the chaos that we would live in our world if we had no rules? If everything was able to be changed, every time we would ignore or break the rules, then we would say, well, who gives you the right to decide? And unfortunately, we're doing that in our spiritual lives. Unfortunately, there are a lot of people who are deciding that God's rules really can be changed. You can make them say whatever you want them to say. And if you don't like the rules, you just do your own thing. And exactly the time that you do that, Satan is delighted. Because he loves it when people believe that they're in charge. He loves it when people walk around thinking, I can do all of this because, hey, I'm in charge. I'm in charge either because I'm intelligent or because I've got a lot of money or I've got a lot of prestige or I've got a heritage behind me or, hey, I'm just in charge because of my personality. I'm in charge because I know more. I whatever the reason is, it's all about me. I'm the guy. I'm the one that's in charge here. And when we do that, when we decide that we are in charge, then we have a tendency as human beings to repeat the bad habits and the behaviors of thousands of people that have been called by God to be faithful, but they don't want to be. You know, there's something about God's rules especially that cause people to whine. And I'm not sure why, but they just do, oh God, I don't really want to do that. I don't want to love on my enemy. I don't want to forgive people that have wronged me. I don't want to abide by your rules. I don't want to be faithful in my marriage. I don't want to worship only one God. I don't want to limit you. I want to limit you by having an idol of my own mind and my own creation. And that's kind of the situation that we find Jesus in when he is giving us the greatest commandment. Up until this point, we've taken a look at the commandments from the Old Testament, the ones that God gave to the people of Israel. Those commandments held true and held faithful all the way through Israel's life and all the way through Israel's history. And then when Jesus came, Jesus was facing an expert in the law. You see, you had your Pharisees, you had your Sadducees, you had your scribes, you had your teachers of the law. And all of these people together were, well, they didn't like Jesus very much. But here in particular is a lawyer, an expert in the law. And this account is found in two places. It's found in Matthew chapter 22, and it's also found in Mark. And so I'm gonna draw a little bit from both of those because they're just a little bit different in their accounts. But Jesus is facing this situation in our text. An expert in the law is asking Jesus, what is the greatest commandment? And he's doing what a lot of people would like to do. Okay, and I can envision this in my own mind. You've got 10 commandments, but wouldn't it be great if we could just have one? You know, then I don't have to keep this checklist of 10 commandments. Let me just do one. And so this expert in the law kind of does that with Jesus. He comes to him and he says, which is the greatest of all of the commandments? Which is the one that we should keep? Of all of the commandments that have been given, all of the rules that are there, let's just kind of boil it all down. One law to rule them all. And so Jesus has a daunting task. How do you shrink the Ten Commandments down into one? When Mark, in Mark chapter 12, verses 28 through 34, writes about the greatest commandment, he mentions that Jesus and the Pharisees are having a debate, and Jesus has answered wisely all of the arguments and all of the debates that the Pharisees are bringing before him. And this lawyer, this expert in the law, is listening to all of this, and as he's listening to all of this, he's pretty impressed with what Jesus is saying. And so in his desire to know, as a lawyer, you know, you're always thinking about the law, which is the greatest law? Which is the one that we really all need to keep? So he asks, which is the greatest commandment? And Jesus' response not only continues the wise responses that he had given to all of the others, but it's very powerful because it describes the very nature of God. So let's take a look at this real quick from the text found in Matthew chapter 22. The words say, hearing that Jesus had silenced the Sadducees, the Pharisees got together, and one of them, an expert in the law, tested him with this question, "Teacher, which is the greatest commandment in the law?" Jesus replied, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment, and the second is like it, love your neighbor as yourself. And the law, all the law and the prophets hang on these two commandments." Some think that the lawyer was trying to trick Jesus. I don't think he was trying to trick Jesus. I don't think he was trying to trap him. In Mark's account, after Jesus provides the response that he gave, which is very similar to the words in Matthew, the lawyer then responds with the words, "You're right." And then he says, "To love him with all your heart, with all your understanding, with all your strength, and to love your neighbor as yourself is more important than all burnt offerings and sacrifices." I don't see a nefarious motive here. Because the lawyer is listening to Jesus' response and going, "Huh, that's right. That's exactly right. This is more important than all of the burnt offerings and sacrifices. All of them. The one law to rule them all is wrapped up in the word love." Love really is what it's all about. Love God, serve God. Everything is in that. And it's really very true. Love is the answer. Love is the purpose that God gave to every person who claims to be a Christian. Love, not intelligence, not devotion to a church, not constantly reading the Bible. Love is really what it's all about. But that kind of puts us in a little bit of a predicament. So if love is what it's all about, what is love? What does it mean to really, truly love? We could go into the Greek, and you may have heard this in the past. This Greek word is agape. It's a kind of love that is deeper and more spiritual than any of the other kinds of loves. It is sacrificial. It is love of the mind, love of the choice, and that's probably the best place to start. Love is not just a feeling. Love really is an attitude. Love is a choice that we make. When I say attitude, that's exactly what I'm talking about. You see, feelings come and go. Emotions, they rise and they fall. We often rule our lives by our emotions. Dr. James Dobson, boy, wow, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, a long time ago, wrote a book called Emotions, Can You Trust Them? And his synopsis was, well, no, you really can't. Our emotions can even get in the way of the truth. Many years ago, I was watching a television show called Mythbusters. Did any of you ever watch Mythbusters? I still watch Mythbusters a little bit on YouTube. And Adam Savage was one of the guys. They would take all of these myths and they would test them with experiments and things to try to first see if they could get the myth to work, and if they couldn't, then why they couldn't, et cetera, et cetera. And in one episode, Adam was just convinced that this was the way that things were going to go, and that this was going to be the results, and this was going to be the truth. And then they did the experiments. They found out that almost exactly the opposite was what happened. And Adam was floored with the fact that everything that he thought he knew was not true. And so his response was, I reject your truth and replace it with my own. And sadly, that's what people are still doing when it comes to God. I reject your truth. I reject your love, and I replace it with my own. Whatever I feel is love must be it. Many people living in a sinful lifestyle are accusing Christians of being hateful and being bigoted because we are trying to stand for God's truth and God's love. They want us to choose love, and you'll see that. You'll see the signs all over. Choose love, choose kindness, don't choose hate. And I'm in agreement with that. But God's command is, first you must love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and then you can love your neighbor as yourself. There is a certain process here. If I am going to love others, I need to first love God. It doesn't work backwards. You see, Satan is once again very pleased, and he is propagating the lie that Christians don't want to be accused of not being loving. So we'll just tolerate any sin. And unfortunately, because that is seeping into churches and into the very core of what Christians are, we're getting churches and ministers and elders and teachers who are accepting of any kind of sin without any kind of repercussions. And then we are accused of being hate mongers. We are accused of not knowing how to love. And it's an unfortunate thing. It's a quandary. And there are some people that even said that God and Jesus really did not understand their own commandment, because there are times where Jesus doesn't seem to be very loving. And yet when you really take a look at what Jesus is doing, he is first loving the Father. Sometimes he said some things that were not very, quote, loving to his own disciples. But they were, because he loved God first. And then he had certain expectations for those who followed him. So this idea of love not being an attitude, or being an attitude and not just being a feeling, is really important. When we try to use the attitude of God's loving nature to love others, then we are following what this command is. And it doesn't work when we try to mix it up the other way, when we love other people first and then just try to make God be okay with it. You see, in responding to the lawyer, Jesus uses some words that the lawyer would know instantly. They're words that are actually found in Deuteronomy chapter 6, verses 4 and 5. They're words that are known as the Shema, if you know anything about the Hebrew faith. These are actually the very first words that every Jewish child would memorize from the time they're capable of learning anything. The Shema was probably spoken every day in the life of a Hebrew child. The word Shema is the very first word of this prayer. It's hear. That's what the Hebrew word means. Shema, hear. Shema Adonai, hear. Shema Israel, hear, O Israel. Adonai, the Lord, our God, is one. The Lord alone. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength. And this is what Jesus went with when the lawyer said, what's the greatest commandment? The greatest commandment is love, but it is not just this modern day love, but it is a love that has been going on since the book of Deuteronomy, since God created mankind. And so this lawyer, hearing the greatest commandment and being teleported all the way back to when his mom and his dad and his grandma and his grandpa and his aunts and his uncles would teach him this prayer, he realized that the greatest commandment has always been with him, and it's been with Israel from the beginning of Israel. Hear the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And so he realized that this love, this greatest commandment of love, starts with a choice. Did the people of Israel give God reason to not love them? Not love him, I mean? Sure. Sure, they didn't love him always. They didn't respect him. They didn't follow his commands. They didn't do what he asked. They betrayed him. They sinned against him. They worshiped other gods. They broke all 10 of the commandments, and yet God still loved them. Even though they rejected him, even though they desecrated his temple, even though they put to death his servants, his prophets, he still loved them. Because it was a choice. You see, that's the thing about love, is it doesn't always feel right. But it is. Love is not only an attitude, but love is also an action. The Bible tells us, let us not love with words or tongue, but with actions and truth. Choose to love God first is an action. Only when this is a priority can we even do the second command. Can we even be actively involved in loving our neighbor as ourselves? Some people see this as a necessary thing. I particularly do. And there are lots of stories of how this is acted out. One that I recently read was a story of a monk in a big Catholic, an abbot, actually. And he promised to give the greatest sermon on love that was ever delivered. And so lots of people showed up at the appointed day. The church was overcrowded with people. And when the monk came up, he watched as the sun set and the rays of the sun dimmed down into darkness. And when the people were standing in the darkness with just the stars and the moon shining, he lit a candle. And as he took that candle through the crowd, he took it up to the crucifix. And then he showed the hands, the nail-pierced hands, and he showed the bloody feet of the statue. He went to the gash in the side where the blood and water flowed, and finally he went up to the head of the crucifix where the crown of thorns, as hard as nails, was pierced into his skull. The twisted body of our Lord. And he just didn't say a word. He just paused as he illuminated each one of these areas. And there were some sniffles in the crowd because people started to realize it. And then he just turned to the crowd and he said, "Go and love likewise." Wow. Do you think you could love like that? Where you would be willing to die for people that you don't even know? I don't know that I could. Love is active, and only when we love others as Jesus loved others and loved us will we grasp our purpose. Jesus told this to the apostles at the Last Supper. He said, "A new command I give to you, love one another as I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this, all men will know that you are my disciples if you love one another." There, that word love is in there so often that it's hard to get around that. Love. That's really what it's all about. Love one another. The other part of this, not only is love an attitude, not only is love active, but love is all. And by all, I mean it includes everything. It includes all of the commandments. It includes everything that emanates from God through the prophets. It includes all of the laws. There is nothing around that isn't touched by love. And of course, people are still trying to justify their behaviors, because even though the Lord said, love your neighbor as yourself, they want to justify their actions, and so they say, well, then who is my neighbor? Who is my neighbor? And there was actually a person who said that to Jesus, and so he went ahead and told them the parable of the Good Samaritan. Who is my neighbor? But the answer was not, who is my neighbor? The answer is, you be a neighbor. And the idea, once again, is not, who is my neighbor, meaning who are the people on my street, but who are the people on my planet? I have neighbors that live in China. I have neighbors that live in Africa, neighbors that live in Mexico. I have neighbors that live in Russia and in Ukraine and in Great Britain and in Norway and Denmark. I have neighbors that live in all of the 124 or 30 countries or however many there are. They are my neighbors. It's not just the people that live two doors or three doors down from you that are your neighbors. Of course, we are still trying as people to justify who we hate and who we don't. I can't stand those people. I can get along with those people. I can tolerate those people. And it is very difficult for us to realize that when Jesus says all the law and the prophets hang on these two commandments, he's literally talking about being inclusive, being all inclusive. There isn't anybody who can be outside of this law of love. Even that person who constantly offends you, we're commanded to love them. Even that person who holds differing political views than we do, we are commanded to love them. Even those people that we just cannot be around, their personality is so different from ours, we are commanded to love them. You see, the greatest commandment does not have any disclaimers or caveats. Jesus doesn't say, love your neighbor, well, except for those ones that you can't get along with. He doesn't say that. There is nobody that is outside of God's love, and the reason for that can be wrapped up in John 3:16. John 3:16 is pretty inclusive. For God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish. When God said, I love the world, and I want you to love your neighbor as yourself, he's talking about the world. He's not just talking about the half a dozen people that you see every day. This greatest commandment is not easy. But the one thing that it does is it really demonstrates the very nature of God. The reason that he wants us to love is because it is his nature. God is love. The hardest thing for me to realize is that God even loves Satan. Now, Satan has rejected God. Satan has done everything. In fact, he is pure evil. But that doesn't mean that God has not loved him. I need to love in that way because God is love. It's an incredible commandment. And it wraps up all of the Ten Commandments, everything in the law, everything in the prophets, all in one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself.